You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. Kentucky's junior Senator Rand Paul didn't speak at last weekend's Fancy Farm picnic, but that didn't stop him from making headlines this past week. Paul has been invited to speak at this year's Republican National Convention. He's also been rumored to be a potential VP running mate for presumptive GOP nominee Mitt Romney. Paul sheds some light on those rumors and discusses his selection for the RNC in an interview with Kentucky Public Radio's Kevin Willis.
Well, we were really excited to get the invitation to speak at the Republican National Convention. I think it's, you know, obviously I've considered to be a great honor to be invited. I think it's also an honor for both Bowling Green and for Kentucky to have someone speak at the National Convention. What we'll talk about is really just the contrast between the different visions, you know, the different visions for the country.
Senator Paul, we've heard you and Governor Romney have really been hitting the president on the issue of taxes and tax fairness. And what do you say to an American who would say to you that maybe I don't believe that the wealthy pay enough in taxes? What do you say to counter that?
Well, I think you just have to look at the facts. When you look at the facts, about 10% of people make over $200,000 a year. They pay 70% of the income tax. About 50% of the people make more than $75,000 a year, and they pay 96% of the income tax. So really the facts are that the wealthy, middle class and above, pay all of the income tax. Those on the bottom end actually receive money back from government through the earned income tax credit. So really what's happened, and particularly with the Bush tax cuts dropped more people off the bottom of the rolls and lowered some of the rates, but actually made the tax code more progressive. So the rich pay almost all of the income tax. The middle class and the rich pay almost all of the income tax. And when people say, oh, it's not their fair share, you just have to look at the facts and look at the numbers. And the bottom line is that the rich do pay most of the income tax in our country.
Senator, how confident are you that all of the Bush tax cuts are going to be extended? Are you going to have to pick and choose some that stay and some that go, or how's that going to work?
Well, you know, the president has wanted to exclude and raise taxes on farmers through the estate tax or small businesses owned by family. He wants to raise and nearly double the estate tax. He also wants to raise taxes on businesses and individuals who make more than $250,000. Now, you may say, well, that's not very many people, but it's about 1 million small businesses in our country. And those people pay an enormous amount of the tax load. So if you look at those over 250, you may say, oh, those rich people, they're not paying enough. Well, they already pay 50% of the income tax. So they're already paying an enormous amount. So if you raise taxes on all those businesses, what you'll get is the unintended consequence, and that's that if you work for one of those businesses, you may no longer have a job. It doesn't work to try to tax or punish rich people. We've tried this. We had a special tax on yachts a few years ago. The rich people just went to the Bahamas to buy their yachts, and the people who lost their jobs were those who made $50,000 and $60,000 a year in our country building the yachts. So it just doesn't work.
Senator, what's the level of support so far for Mitt Romney's campaign amongst the Tea Party? Do you think Tea Party members are going to turn out in high enough numbers this November to support Mitt Romney?
Yeah, and I think the case, you know, when we lost the case in the Supreme Court against Obamacare, I think all the Tea Party voters now realize that our only chance to repeal it is at the ballot box. And I think they have begun to coalesce around Romney.
Senator, you mentioned the recent Supreme Court decision regarding the Affordable Care Act. You were quoted afterwards as, and I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but I believe it was to the effect of, just because a few people on the Supreme Court say something is constitutional doesn't mean it is. Could you explain what you meant by that, and do you regret that at all?
No, I stand by that. What I meant by that is that I think that Obamacare is still unconstitutional. I took the question to mean, for example, if you were interviewing Justice Scalia today and you ask him, does he still think it's unconstitutional, even though the court voted and decided, and obviously it is valid for now, he still would tell you he believes it's unconstitutional. I think so would Justice Thomas. I think if Madison were here today, Madison would tell you, the father of the Constitution would tell you that he thinks it's unconstitutional, because Madison was very explicit. He said, you know, the taxing authority is not unlimited. We can't tax and make you do anything we want to. We can only tax you according to what the enumerated powers are, the powers that were given to Congress in the Constitution. So this debate's a long one, and it's not really over. You know, we have Supreme Court cases, and we sometimes go decades till we correct previous bad decisions. You know, at one time, Dred Scott was the law of the land, and it was an awful Supreme Court decision. So was Plessy versus Ferguson. So we've come about and changed and corrected previous problems. I think this was a mistake, and I think ultimately, if we get a more original understanding of the Constitution, we'll reverse this mistake.
Senator, where do things stand? What's the current timeline on your bill that would cut USAID to Pakistan?
Dr. Afridi is the doctor who helped get us information on bin Laden, and then the Pakistani government, you know, imprisoned him for life. And he was supposed to have an appeal in July, and they canceled that and rescheduled for August 30th. If he is not released, if they don't reevaluate the information and let him go, then we will have a vote on it in the U.S. Senate shortly thereafter. I have the signatures required to discharge this, to force the leadership to let me have a vote. It's not easy, though. I have to gain access to the floor, and you would think a U.S. senator would be allowed to have access. Physically, you're allowed to go down there, but procedurally, they won't let you bring up a bill. And so it will be a fight and a tussle, but they also need me to get out of the way to let them pass other things. And we will have to pass spending bills and things like that, or the government shuts down. And we'll play hardball with them, and we'll see how far they want to play this out just to avoid voting. They could always vote me down, but I'm not going to let them have no vote. And so we will see what happens. And this may be an epic battle with Harry Reid, depending on which way he decides to go on this.
So, Senator, do I hear you to say, like, you would be willing to maybe use procedural tactics to hold up other pieces of legislation unless you are given the right to at least bring your Pakistan aid bill up for an official vote?
Yeah, exactly, because they're doing the same thing to stop me from having the vote.
Wouldn't such a bill, though, Senator, even if it passed the Senate, if it passed the House, wouldn't it be vetoed by the president?
Well, that would be an interesting thing to see. And that's another thing. I would love to see the president take a position on this. Now, the other day in the House, they did vote to cut Pakistan's aid in half. So there is a growing consensus that Pakistan, you know, if they want to be our ally, and they have helped us in the war on terror, but if they really want to be our ally, they need to start acting like it.
Are you worried at all about the potential of losing what influence we have with Pakistan if such a bill became a reality?
I think our influence with other countries should be that we trade with them. If they're our allies, we might even sell weapons to them. But I don't think we have to give them gifts. I don't think you have to buy your friends. Anybody that's ever seen a child try to buy a friend with money, you don't get real friends that way. It's the same way between countries.
Kentucky Public Radio's Kevin Willis speaking to Kentucky U.S. Senator Rand Paul.
The Panama Canal expansion project promises to increase river traffic in our region, but to service those ships, area ports will need to invest money to make the changes necessary to accommodate large ships. The Alabama Port Authority has made some of those investments in Mobile. Vice President of Trade and Development for the Port Authority, Mark Shepard, spoke to Paducah Area Chamber of Commerce members as a follow-up to a transportation summit the chamber held in May 2011. Chamber President Elaine Spalding said ports in Mobile and Paducah must coordinate to handle larger vessels that could arrive from the expanded Panama Canal or from other locations. Casey Northcutt sat down with Shepard after the event to add some details to this big project.
Well, for listeners who don't know, why are officials in Panama expanding the canal, and how does it affect our port in the Purchase area?
The canal was built about 100 years ago. It's a system of locks that go up to a lake, so the vessels will go through the locks, get into the lake, go across the lake, and then go back down through the locks. The locks are all gravity-fed. They are currently 1,000 feet long and 110 feet wide. The largest container vessels going through at this time are about 5,000 20-foot containers. When the new locks are complete, ships will be able to go through that have up to 12,000 20-foot containers. So it's a large increase in size. And it's the container growth of over the past 20 or 30 years has just been, you know, double digits every year. And I don't think you're going to see that continuing, but you've seen it. It's always been an arrow going up for the most part. There's a lot of commodities that 20 years ago they were not putting in containers. Now they are. They're putting export grain containers. Anything that they can get in a container, that's what it's going to go in.
So Panama has to be prepared for that.
The locks were 100 years old. when they built those locks. Teddy Roosevelt was president. They were considered very large locks at the time. 20 years ago, the largest container ships were a little over 4,000 20-foot containers, and now they're building ships that are 18,000 20-foot containers in capacity. So now those will not be going through the canal, but you will have a capacity of 12,000 TEU ships going through the canal. So it's a huge, huge infrastructure project.
What's a TEU?
A TEU is a measurement of a 20-foot equivalent unit. Most of your containers that you see are 40-foot containers. So one 40-foot container is two TEUs. It's just a way to measure the volumes of movement or capacity.
So I'm assuming this is going to create some obstacles for ports all across America.
Those size ships will not be able to there'll be a select number of ports they can go to. Currently, a ship that is over 8,000 TEUs in size can't call New York, which is a major, major consumption area. It does not have to do with the draft, the water draft, but the air draft. They can't get under a bridge. New York is looking to correct that. Most East Coast ports have less than 50 foot of draft, so they're all scrambling. Your major ones, your Savannah, your Charleston, scrambling to have their studies done and approved by the Corps and find funding to prepare it for them. But it has more to do with water draft, and also some of the cranes aren't going to be big enough. They're going to have improvements in shoreside cranes.
What obstacles has your port faced, and what have you done to prepare for them?
We have recently completed, and it was a federal-funded and Port Authority-funded project. We built a new turning basin. When the ships come up the river, they have to be able to turn around. The turning basin that we just completed was about a $23, $26 million project, opened about a year and a half ago. That allows any ship that will be able to get through the canal can turn. We do have an old turning basin that's further up the river that was smaller, and the larger ships could not turn there. That's about a $23, $26 million project.
Casey Northcutt spoke with Vice President of Trade and Development for the Alabama Port Authority, Mark Shepard, about changes on the horizon due to an expansion of the Panama Canal. What if you could get a haircut for $20, every penny of which goes to the Humane Society of Callaway County? And what if that haircut was from master hairstylist and animal lover Patrick Lomantini of Wichita, Kansas? Well, you can do just that. Lomantini's in his second year of doing 50 haircuts in 50 states in 50 days, and he's made Murray his Kentucky stop. Humane Society Executive Director Kathy Hodge tells Kate Lochte all about it.
The Humane Society has a really neat idea working for August, and Kathy Hodge, tell me about it.
Well, it's exciting, isn't it? It's a totally different idea for fundraising. He's a master hairstylist. He has a salon in Wichita, Kansas. And so he's been in business for several years and has, you know, an amazing reputation amongst the hairstylists. But for all the enthusiasm he has for his work, he has the same kind of passion for animals. And last year he wanted to do something to really call attention to homeless animals across the country and something that he could do. So he decided to do 50 haircuts in 50 states in 50 days. And he set about last year putting that kind of event together. He had such good luck with it, raised almost $50,000 for animal groups all over the United States, and he decided to do it again this year. So he started out on August the 1st in Maine. He's working his way toward Murray, Kentucky, so will be his Kentucky stop, and he will be here on August the 23rd. He wants to have 50 haircut appointments between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. on the 23rd, and he's asking for a $20 donation to the Humane Society for each of those cuts. So we're busy making appointments. We're so grateful to the hair studio and to Kina Bomar over at that studio. It's on 901 Sycamore. She's giving us the space for Patrick Lomantini to come in and do the haircuts here on the 23rd.
Do you have any appointments left?
We do. We have some left. We're booking up pretty quickly, which is exciting. exciting because we just got out our, you know, serious publicity in the last couple of days. So we're anxious to fill up the entire schedule if we possibly can. It's a 15-minute appointment on average. And walk-ins are welcome, but certainly we would love to have most of those scheduled appointments prior to the 23rd.
I see you've already got Coach Prohm scheduled.
We do. He was one of our first appointments, actually. So we're looking forward to having him. I think he's coming fairly early that morning before he gets his day started. So he'll be one of the first haircuts and donors for us that morning.
Again, it's really unusual and great that he's coming to Murray, Kentucky. How did that work out?
Yeah, that was sort of exciting. One of the girls who works at Orscheln's here in Murray's mom lives in Delaware, and he had actually come to her hometown there in Delaware last year. So she found out about it from her mom, and then she emailed him and said, you know, he'd gone to Lexington last time for his Kentucky stop. And she said, you know, you need to come down to Western Kentucky. We would love to have you here. And we were all a little surprised when he said that would be great. So Murray will be his Kentucky stop, but it was because of a Delaware connection. So the internet makes a world of difference on these things for sure. And some people are interested in just looking at the schedule that he has and where he's going to be, and that's got that posted on his Facebook page. And you can go to 50 States Tour, and it will bring up his Facebook page, and you can see where he is and what he's, you know, how much money he's making at the various stops that he's making along the way, and sort of keep track until he gets here on the 23rd.
What's the potential for total earning from this one day of haircutting?
You know, if we fill the appointments and everybody does the suggested donation of the, you know, of the $20, then the potential is just $1,000 right there. We have had several people say, oh, I just got my hair cut. I can't participate because I don't want my hair any shorter, but we'd love to donate, you know. So obviously donations are more than happy to accept those, because a lot of folks will want to participate in that way, or maybe their schedule, they're going to be out of town or whatever, and they just can't participate as one of the appointments. But we're delighted to have the donations. They're taking the donations at the hair studio, or we'll certainly take them here at the Humane Society as well. And we're doing the appointments by email primarily because that's available. We've got a volunteer that can check it, you know, all hours of the day and night, so we can get back to people quickly and give them their confirmations on their appointments. So if they do want to schedule an appointment, they can go to forthepets@yahoo.com. And just give them your name, information, the time that's best for you to come for your appointment, and she'll get right back with you and give us a phone number in case we have any details that we need to check with you on. But we feel like that's a pretty quick way to get the appointments taken care of. And I think we're about halfway full on the appointments right now, so we'd love to get them all filled up in the next week or so.
Kathy, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
You can check forthepets@yahoo.com to see if there are still appointments available for the Lomantini Tour Stop in Murray on August 23rd. The proceeds from your shorn locks goes to benefit the Humane Society of Callaway County. A look at the funding problems and construction delays at Kentucky's Ark Encounter Park, and an update on the Hopkins County Madisonville Public Library's quest for a new permanent home are coming up after the break. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. The Ark Encounter Theme Park, or what many people are calling the Ark Park, is a planned theme park in northern Kentucky that's been plagued by fundraising difficulties and construction delays. Kentucky Public Radio's Gabe Bullard speaks with Louisville's Leo Weekly reporter, Joe Sonka, who's been reporting on the situation surrounding the park.
What is this park? Tell us about it.
It is a recreation of Noah's Ark, really the brainchild of Answers in Genesis, and Ken Ham, their CEO, who, of course, are known for the famous Creation Museum in Northern Kentucky. And what they're planning to do is rebuild Noah's Ark and turn this into a huge theme park that they expect millions of people to come to every year.
Now, and in rebuilding Noah's Ark, and for people who have read up on the Creation Museum and on this project as well, the two of every animal story is told, but some animals will be on the Ark that maybe certain people don't expect.
Yes, there will be dinosaurs on the Ark because according to Ken Ham and his ministry, the Earth is 6,000 years old, and humans used to ride on the back of saddled dinosaurs and caravans through the desert. So it's very it's a very unique perspective on history and science.
So this will be a very large replica of the Ark. We'll be able to walk in and
yes.
see, you know, the lions and the tigers and the dinosaurs.
And the T-Rexes, yes.
This project is planned. It's a very expensive project.
Originally, it was supposed to be about a $150 million project, and they were supposed to break ground on it last spring, but they've run into very sluggish fundraising. I went to a meeting in Williamstown, where this is going to be built, last August, and Mike Zovath from Answers in Genesis was saying that they had raised $100 million. They had almost raised it all, and they were telling citizens there that the streets were about to be paved in gold. But as the year went on, the fundraising was kind of stuck on $4 million. And eventually they announced this year that they're going to have to do it in phases. And the total cost of the first phase will be about $73 million. But I went to the Creation Museum for a little preview that they put on for Ark Encounter. And they are a very long way from getting the money that they need even to break ground. They're $22 million away from only being able to break ground and $44 million away from the total amount of money that they will need to actually build the Ark. So whereas they once were expecting a spring 2014 opening, this could be as late as 2016 based on the time estimates that they gave.
For the opening of the first phase?
Yes.
What is in the first phase?
The first phase will be the boats, and it will be three layers on the boat that will show Noah's family caring and feeding for all of the animals. And there will also be festive things, a parade of animals where people dressed up as the animals going on the boat will have a parade. Meanwhile, actors dressed as pagans will be heckling Noah as he gets onto the boat. But they're still quite a ways away.
How are they going about raising this money? How's this working?
It's a mixture of funds that Answers in Genesis is raising and also private investors. At the preview, they said that they were trying to get investors to give a $100,000 minimum in order to have part ownership of the park. And they were saying that, and their materials that they gave out were saying that people after 10 years would get a 20% return on their investment.
And there is some state assistance coming in here as well.
Well, there was $43 million in state tax incentives that were potentially available for them. But one of the key parts of that is they're only rebated 25% of what they spent on construction by the spring of 2014. Based on the time estimates that they gave, they might not even break ground by that time. So if that's the case, then they actually won't get any rebates. But the state has already allocated $2 million towards road infrastructure improvement around the exit. And they're doing this because their estimates say that millions of people are going to be coming here. So $2 million has already been allocated, and there's a potential for $9 million
more. You mentioned, you know, they're estimating that millions of people will be coming. Where do those numbers come from?
They come from, first of all, it was a feasibility study done by someone who actually is a co-author of two of Ken Ham's books. And the state, actually, the tourism cabinet actually did another feasibility study, I guess it was last spring, when they were finally accepted for the tax incentives. And they had lower estimates, but they still also said that there would be many, many people coming here.
And how has the Creation Museum been going? Is it the tourist attraction that it was sold as at first?
Well, it is drawing in people. Last year, they had pretty low attendance based on their other years. They had about 280,000 people, but it was packed when I went there Saturday, so they're still making plenty of money.
And I want to return to this idea of the tax incentives, and if they were not to get those, would that calm some of the controversy around this whole thing, since there was the constitutional question earlier?
There's still the question of whether this is giving the state of Kentucky a black eye, that where people laugh at us from around the country and say that we're backwards, and for the governor to proudly stand behind this project, which is telling people that 6,000 years ago, a 600-year-old man herded T-Rexes onto a giant boat. It's kind of embarrassing for the state.
Joe Sonka from Leo Weekly. The story is Investors of the Lost Ark. Joe, thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you, Gip.
The Hopkins County Madisonville Public Library has been beset with difficulties, specifically regarding a physical location. Currently, the library is housed in its third location since a project to renovate the original downtown Doolin building started 3 years ago. The library was most recently located in Madisonville's Parkway Plaza Mall, but a new shoe store is moving into that area. The library now has another space in the mall until the end of the year. And now the renovation project on the downtown Doolin building has hit a snag. Rose Kristen Presson spoke with Library Board Director Marcella Davis to get this update on what library officials are doing to maintain normal library services, as well as find a permanent location.
From what I understand, part of the wall in the downtown building collapsed.
Well, I don't think it totally collapsed. It is in a condition where if there were a lot of pressure from exterior forces, it could collapse. So there may be a few bricks that have fallen out, but it is not a collapsed wall at this time.
Do you know if you guys are still going to take out your $700,000 loan for the renovations?
Well, at this time, with the new information that we've received regarding the structure issues, we're back to looking at possible options of location. So I think that will shape any work that we do toward funding.
You guys are a little unique in that you don't receive the base tax funds that most libraries in the state receive. Would you tell me a little about that?
That's been an ongoing issue over the past many years. I believe that Hopkins County is one of only two or three counties in the state that do not have this tax support. It is something that has been considered over the past many years, but because of economic conditions and whatever, it has not been passed in our area. Someday, perhaps.
So where are you guys getting funding from?
We receive funding from the city of Madisonville, from the county of Hopkins, from the city of Dawson Springs, some from the state.
Have you guys had to raise funds yourself outside of that?
Well, there is an annual luncheon that has taken place over the past several years, and there is some money that is brought in by library services, such as printing and those kinds of things that are done for the community.
Is there a timeline that's set to be in a permanent location?
Well, we need to vacate the mall site that we are now in by the end of this year. And our hope was to be back in the downtown site at that time. However, we're now back in planning stages. So depending on the information we get from the architects, the engineers about the conditions of the buildings and decide where we will actually be located, it's still a question.
So with all these moves and everything, the summer programs or back to school things that the library would normally do, have those still been able to go?
The reading program was done in conjunction with one of the elementary schools here in town. We've collaborated with some of the Murray Educations. We've collaborated with the YMCA. So we're working with different institutions in the community to continue and maintain those operational services.
Do you think the library is adequately serving the community?
I think our staff there is doing a wonderful job in maintaining the services with the smaller space that they are now located in. The bookmobile is still serving the community. The reading programs are continuing. So they, I think, are doing an amazing job with all the challenges that we've faced.
Where do you see the future of the library going?
Well, as a longtime board member, I would hope that the future entails a stable, modern, well-lit, welcoming site, preferably downtown in Madisonville, with the technology that the public could best make use of, and lots of books and services for children and people of all ages. So that's our dream.
Rose Kristen Presson spoke with Hopkins County Library Board Director Marcella Davis.
The Roman Catholic missionary who founded the Christian Appalachian Project passed away early this past Thursday. Since World War II, Monsignor Ralph Biting served the people of eastern Kentucky through a series of social service programs. Kentucky Public Radio's Charles Compton knew Monsignor Biting and brings us this appreciation.
At first, the Reverend Ralph Biting didn't want to come to Appalachia. As a seminary student, well before joining the priesthood, Biting argued the point with his bishop. The Northern Kentuckian said his family needed him, but the bishop was boss and somewhat intimidating. So the student found himself spending the summer in Paintsville.
I saw things that summer that I had never realized were possible. I found out that there was another America, the America of Appalachia. I found poverty that I had never seen, even in the Great Depression. And I saw prejudice from one church to against another that I had never recognized or seen before.
Biting described those early days in an interview with NPR's StoryCorps. A few years later, in 1950, Father Biting was sent to Madison County to launch a church there. The young missionary's welcome was not warm. A neighbor circulated a petition demanding an expulsion of the Catholic Church from Berea.
He didn't want the property values to go down, and he was sure that if it was a Catholic church there, they would.
In Berea, there was no building, no money, and just a half dozen Catholics. Biting wanted to go home, but late one night, during prayer, the Catholic priest changed his mind.
As I describe it, that was the day I lost my mind. I no longer was going to think as a human folk. I was no longer going to try to ration things out according to the sensible way. I was going to put my hands in the hands of God, and I was going to go wherever he left me.
Biting continued his mission work, building churches, spreading the faith, and raising money. At night, Biting would comb telephone books from Chicago, Philadelphia, and New York, looking for Irish, German, and Italian households, and then he'd mail them appeals for cash. He began to realize fighting evil in eastern Kentucky meant fighting poverty. That revelation came to him as an employer. When building churches, Biting often hired local laborers. One day, the priest was invited to a worker's home to see his newborn child.
So he takes me into this little shed and takes me over in the corner, and he said, "Ain't it a pretty thing?" And I said, "Oscar, it's a beautiful little baby, but why do you have it in this wire cage? A little fine chicken wire surrounding it." He said, "Well, so the rats won't eat on it." And I began to understand something of poverty.
In the 1950s, Biting launched one of the first fully integrated summer camps for boys. By 1964, his ministry had evolved into the Christian Appalachian Project. CAP, as it's often known, is an interdenominational nonprofit organization that serves Kentucky's mountain residents. A warehouse and thrift store in Louisa also bears his name. The center distributes food, clothing, and furniture, and provides 4 thrift stores with low-cost merchandise. In his final years, Biting worked with the residents of Martin County. An early collaborator was Father Terrence Hoppenjans, who still serves in eastern Kentucky.
When people are in need, they ask him for things, and he goes out and gets them for them, whether it be a car, whether it be a refrigerator, whether it be whatever it might be. That his generosity is such that he is always concerned about others, not just himself, and that's one of the things that has impressed me and has encouraged me as well to try to emulate and to try to follow that example.
In 2009, when celebrating 60 years as a priest, the Monsignor talked about his legacy. Biting asked the faithful to continue his work after his death. He said, "We have to be an answer to Appalachia. We can never let the poor go untended." For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Charles Compton.
Yes, and how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
When we come back, we'll meet a world champion pool professional from Metropolis, Illinois, whose love of the game keeps the cue stick in his hand even after a 50-year career. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Growing up in Metropolis, Illinois, all Buddy Hall ever wanted to do was play pool. He got his wish. Hall was a pool professional for more than 50 years. He's the winner of 67 majors, 13 world titles, a five-time Player of the Year, and a member of three Halls of Fame, including the Billiard Congress of America Hall of Fame. These days, he's retired, or at least semi-retired. He has slowed down, but says he just can't keep away. Angela Hatton caught up with Hall at a tournament in Murray.
The name of tonight's game is Nine Ball. A few dozen players are scattered around four tables in a dark backroom pool hall. They blast the white cue through balls arranged in a diamond pattern on the table. The goal? Sink the balls 1 through 9 in number order, stacking up points for every ball sunk. Sink the nine ball at any time, game over. Players go several rounds before yielding the table to the next two in the tournament. Buddy Hall sits at a table in the corner, waiting his turn. He stands out, a big man and the oldest in the room, and the other players give him a deferential respect. Hall started playing at 15, picking up the game from his uncle. As a teenager, Hall would skip school to go to the local pool hall where he swept floors in exchange for time at the table, because he was too poor to pay for it out of pocket.
That's all I wanted to do, was play pool. Heck, I had loved it so much I didn't get interested in girls until I was about 18, you know.
The 67-year-old Hall learned by watching other players and trying out the way they did it. If it worked for him, he kept it up. If it didn't, he dropped it. He was 17 when he won his first tournament.
It paid $500. That wasn't bad for a 17-year-old kid back then.
What'd you do with the money?
God knows I don't.
Hall practiced constantly. He'd throw balls out on the table, sink them until he missed one, and start again. He got good fast, winning tournaments around the country.
I just worked hard. I played a lot of pool, and I wasn't playing like it was a job. I was playing for the fun of it because I loved to play. When I saw somebody that played better than me, my goal was to play better than them. And I accomplished that in a lot of times.
Hall says he's seen many good players. They're systematic. They aim from good positions and make good shots.
But a great player is somebody that comes with something extra, that he'll have shots that other people don't see, but he does. And he's able to go that one step farther.
Buddy's taught us all a lot about the game and what we didn't even know we should be paying attention to about the game, you know.
Brian Steele's new to tournaments, and he plays with Hall in Metropolis.
Pool's a game of chess, of decisions. Best man make best decisions, wins financially in life and on the green.
Green meaning pool table felt. For example, Steele says before he met Hall, he was trying to sink every ball. He didn't know about missing correctly.
A bank shot's 60-40 odds, so that's not high percentage. If you miss it correctly, it's 100% odds that they're probably not going to beat you when it's their turn again. And then you get another chance, even if you miss.
The number of people playing pool has risen dramatically since Hall's early years. Billiard Congress of America says the game almost died out in the 60s and 70s because of pool hall's poor reputations and more interest in outdoor activities. Upscale pool rooms caused resurgence in the 80s. Now more than 12 million Americans play pool regularly, according to the 2012 USA Sports Participation Survey. Steele has his own theories about the popular rise. He says in Hall's day, the only way to learn was to make mistakes. But these days, Steele's generation goes online to look for techniques and strategies.
We all, I guess, essentially cheated and run a CD off and didn't pay for it, you know, in a way, with the computer. And I don't know if that's wrong, but we're learning a lot easier than what them good old boys did. How many guys spent that much time, and then they wouldn't share the information because they weren't getting paid.
Hall's turn to play comes up, and he racks the balls and hits the open break, sending them scattering over the green. He loses the first game and wins the second, but tonight's not his night. Hall finishes the tournament middle of the pack. He calls the loss terrible, but he's played long enough to not let it get to him.
As long as you play the game, you're going to pay your dues. You're going to get good rolls, you're going to get bad rolls. You're going to miss shots, and you're going to make shots, as long as you play the game. So there's no such thing as I've paid my dues. Long as you play pool, you're going to keep paying your dues.
For Hall, there's always another tournament and another chance. For WKMS News, I'm Angela Hatton.
Paducah's Yeiser Arts Center opens a solo exhibition next weekend of Southern Indiana artist Rob Millard Mendez. Much of the sculpture in his show harkens back to his youth on board his father's fishing boat in Massachusetts. Millard Mendez blends a wry sense of humor with an unusual amount of depth in his work. Drew Adams speaks with Mendez about his work and sense of humor.
I'm the son of a fisherman who fished out of Gloucester, which is a famous fishing town in Massachusetts. And A Feeble Armada is a series of boat sculptures that are all kind of conceptually disparate in the ways that they take on ideas about travel. A lot of them attempt to be funny. I'm really interested in the idea of craft and how it interacts with art. So,
and the attempt to be funny thing, I've got to kind of disagree with you there. I mean, when I roll through your portfolio and search you online and see some of your work, one of the first things that comes to mind is that your pieces are often very, very humorous in nature. Is that something you strive for?
I think it's something that I attempt in many ways to add a levity to every aspect of my life and my teaching and my just general demeanor. And I try to attempt a wry sense of humor. There's more than a little irony in many of them. I enjoy puns and wordplay, and those things kind of enter into the work quite a bit as well. So I think even though many of the things are serious in tone, I think they attempt to sort of put a veneer of humor over that.
With the Feeble Armada, was this something that was ongoing? I mean, have you developed these pieces over years, and did you always know that you wanted to create something that was an homage to your father in a roundabout way?
Absolutely, and I spent a lot of time on boats as a young person preparing work, preparing objects for the boat, preparing lines and cutting up chum and doing a lot of things before I could even officially be on the boat in the capacity of a fisherman. You know, I think if you ever read The Old Man and the Sea, there's a lot of great scenes in there of the struggle of human and fish. And that's something that hasn't gone away. If you look now at how bluefin tuna is hunted and caught, it's a very human struggle. You know, it's like biceps and lines. It's really interesting how primal a lot of that stuff is. So that imagery is something that's quite powerful in my mind.
Do you find you expressing any of your life experiences on those boats in the work itself?
There's a cliche in art that everything that you make is a self-portrait, and I think there's a little bit of truth in that.
It seems that a lot of your work tends to elicit, I would say, a strong response. When people see it for the first time, the reaction tends to be strong as opposed to looking at something that's considered more classical, where there's more of an internalized reaction. I showed a lot of your work to people in the office, and there's almost always a very animated response. Is that something that you've experienced before?
Absolutely. The kind of art that I'm intrigued with the most and that I enjoy the most is folk art. I think I'm aiming to try to evoke a response from people. There's a bit of my artist statement about how I'm trying to give something to every viewer. So I think there's something visual, and there's something of a slapstick humor to them. But there's also, if you want to look at it with a much more critical or analytical lens, I'm trying to give something for the structuralist or postmodernist fan as well. There's meant to be many layers to them, and I think that the lower brow aspects of them are things that elicit the kind of responses that I want, and they kind of prime you if you're ready to respond to them.
I've noticed in some of your work there's a sense of interactivity. A lot of the works that you can interact with, what's the impetus behind that, and why build art that someone has to manipulate?
I very much enjoy the idea of toys and how it causes a physical interaction between the viewer and the object and the connections that we have to toys over time. In fact, the scale of many of these is very toy-like. The miniature boat itself kind of evokes quality of youth, of imagination, because you're working on this tiny thing and imagining it being so big. I did at one point make many things that you could physically touch and turn cranks and press buttons, but I found that people, once they found out that they could touch them, tended to overwork them or play with them too hard or crank them too much and break them. So And it was mostly the guys. So I think they, once they realized they could play with them, they kind of saw how fast they could make a thing do something. So I quit for a while making stuff that people could touch, just because I would continue to get calls from the curator or the gallery director saying that I had to come fix the work. So these have the sense that they could be interacted with, but I'd prefer people didn't touch them.
Raul Millard Menendez, thank you so very much for speaking with me.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
The opening reception for Rob Millard Mendez's Feudal Armada is Saturday, August 18th at Paducah's Yeiser Art Center.
Just in case your kids don't have their extracurricular activities mapped out for this fall, the Murray Art Guild is offering arts classes year-round for young people. WKMS youth reporter Austin Cobb attended some this summer and brings us this report.
I'm Austin Cobb here at the Murray Art Guild with clay class teacher Reed Parrish.
Why did you start this class, and what do you hope for the students to get out of it?
We started it to give the young people here in the city of Murray an avenue of creativity, to let them explore their own personal interests via the mechanism of clay.
You teach a younger and older class. So what are some of the favorite projects in each?
Well, this week with the younger crowd, we have a pirate theme. And so it's a chance for us to put on our pirate persona, so to speak, and really have fun with it. They have made bowls in the form of little fish and then painted those. And today we made cups. All pirates need a mug to drink out of. They have made little caves to put pirate treasure in. And as we turn it around, this one has coins attached to it, and there's a sea turtle over here, and this was a shark and a sea star. And right on the very top, it has a very happy, smiley fish.
Mr. Parrish challenged us older kids to make a sculpture 17 inches tall and 5 inches wide. I turned mine into a funky Easter Island head. Next, I found Mr. Wyatt Seavers in the wood shop. All this week, you've been teaching a woodworking class. Why did you start this class, and what do you hope for the students to get out of it?
Well, I just hope they get a little creative thought process going in their brain and look at objects that are constructed a little differently after learning some of the knowledge of how things are constructed with wood. You know, everybody does something a little differently. I try not to put stipulations on them. I find that with freedom, they come up with something within a few seconds on their own, and that's how we do it.
Wyatt gave us some parameters to make our boxes out of stakes and dowels. We put doors and locks on them and turned them into safes.
Let me see the screws that came.
Finally, I spoke with Deb Danielson, director at the Murray Art Guild.
What are some of the options young and old artists have here at the Murray Art Guild?
Our workshops are for youth and adults, and they will be in clay, oil painting, woodworking. As far as events goes, two things coming up this fall will be important. We have an empty bowls project, which artists have been working on throughout the year, making clay bowls that we will then host a soup dinner for the community. And for a minimum donation, the participants can have a bowl of soup, some bread, take home a bowl that they picked out. All the funds raised from that project go to Murray Needline. Our second big event that we have coming up in the fall is our Art Hop. That Art Trolley Hop will be on September 15th, and that involves exhibitions at the Art Guild as well as the Robert O. Miller Center, local gallery 109, exhibitions at Murray State University. And the trolley will run a continuous circle and take participants to the exhibits at all the locations.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell me about the Art Guild and its purposes?
Well, recently we had a summer full of youth workshops, and I really enjoyed those a lot. It was something that I think that the Guild offers is what I like to call the other education. It's an opportunity for youth and adults to learn in a very supportive environment in kind of a one-on-one learning situation. And that's, I think, been one of the most exciting things to watch happen at the Guild.
The Guild workshops cover painting, ceramics, woodworking, jewelry making, weaving, and more for all ages and abilities. Keep an eye on the Murray Art Guild webpage for fall workshop offerings.
I'm Austin Cobb for the Youth Radio Project.
Having double doors is obviously harder to do than single.
About twice as hard, actually.
You can see a slideshow of Austin's trip to the Art Guild at WKMS.org. WKMS Youth Project volunteer Dr. Barbara Cobb coordinated this story, and you can learn more about the Youth Radio Project as well as how your child can participate by emailing us at msu.wkms@murraystate.edu.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Angela Hatton, Casey Northcutt, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Mark Graff provides website assistance.
If you have comments or questions about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say on our Facebook page, and there's a link to that at our website, wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Thanks for listening.